This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Forget conspiracy. Contrails are real and dangerous to the climate. From Sweden's Chalmers University of Technology, Dr. Daniel Johansson. While thousands died of heat in Europe in 2003, a marine heat wave ripped the North Atlantic at the same time. Changes to marine life remain today. From Germany, Dr. Karl Michael Werner of the Thunen Institute of Sea Fisheries in Bremerhaven reports. Meanwhile, the pillars of wealth remain oblivious at Davos. Full speed ahead, fossil fuel for a hot, militarized world. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for joining us. For a while, it seemed like money power got it. We were heading over the precipice of climate change and the limits of nature. Just 6 years ago, the chief executive of the world's largest pool of wealth, Larry Fink, promised at Davos to transform finance away from fossil fuels. Banks in many parts of the world made commitments, weak and gradual, sure, but promises to stop fueling disaster with more investments in fossil fuels. Most of the green funds and promises have been ditched. It's every country for themselves announcing emergency action on fossil fuels for nation building, national defense, and even new colonization. Here's a short clip from the New York Times reporter David Gelles on Davos, January 2026.
The World Economic Forum was ground zero for the birth of the climate movement on Wall Street. But this year, climate has really taken a back seat. And at the end of the day, the business community wasn't ready to sacrifice its profits in the name of combating climate change.
So how did this movement start? Well, it began in 2020.
How do we frame an investment portfolio that will be able to thoughtfully navigate climate change?
The CEO of BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, wrote a letter calling on the financial community in particular to take climate change seriously. In the years that followed, just about every major financial institution joined the bandwagon. You saw major banks, including JP Morgan and Bank of America, pledge to start reducing their emissions and start changing their lending practices to support clean energy and potentially even reduce their business with fossil fuel companies. So at the very time, you saw big firms introducing new products aimed at addressing sustainability and capitalizing on it. You had Republicans and conservatives around the country finding ways to try to stop it. And then President Trump was reelected at the end of 2024.
We're going to be crushing Biden-era environmental restrictions.
Since then, he has used his perch in the Oval Office to tamp down the clean energy industry in the United States, promote fossil fuels. And now we've seen many of the companies that said they were going to back away from fossil fuels instead line up and invest record amounts in the expansion of the fossil fuel business. So where does this leave us? Many of the people I've spoken to for this story say that rather than help solve the issue of climate change, it seems like Wall Street these days is contributing to it.
With executives and the richest of the rich in attendance, well, this year Elon Musk presented, Davos previously featured whole sessions on meeting the climate challenge. This year, I found only Trump's obsession with windmills and this short clip from Swedish scientist Johan Rockström.
With the three sources of scientific evidence that proves that we now have overwhelming evidence of the need to transition the global economy within prosperity, within planetary boundaries. The first one is that the human pressures on the planet has now reached a crisis point. The era where we can continue with economic growth without putting the stability of the planet at risk has come to an end. Welcome to the Anthropocene. The second is that these pressures on the planet are now at risk of causing irreversible, potentially catastrophic tipping points that would irreversibly drift away from the life support we depend on. And the third is that we are now understanding, for the first time with scientific evidence, that our world economy depends on the extraordinary stability of the Holocene. We leave the last ice age 18,000 years ago and enter what you see here, this extraordinarily stable 12,000 year, which is a 14 degrees Celsius global mean surface temperature with a maximum variability. Can you imagine? A plus minus 0.5 degrees Celsius, which gives us the corridor of life that is the basis for all our life support.
That was it. Johann Rockström, almost from another room, trying to pierce the curtains, the willful blindness of men, and it is mostly men, at the top of the money machine. Climate? Oh, this is no time for climate. There is gold to seize, weapons, castles, and monuments to build. Outside, scientists who still have funding continue observations and calculations. The whole environment is changing with us inside it. It is difficult to keep up. Some underreported tidbits follow this week's guests. Let's take to the air. Business Insider tracked 157 private jets arriving near Davos as billionaires and world leaders flew to the Swiss Alps for the World Economic Forum's annual meeting. It was the busiest travel week in Swiss history. According to Greenpeace, the number of private planes this year was 10% more than last and triple the number in 2023. So let's investigate what those planes leave behind in the atmosphere.
Radio EcoShock.
Here is a puzzle for you. Flying causes about 2.5% of global carbon dioxide emissions, but it adds about 4% to global warming. Why? Planes also create contrails and high clouds that add to warming. Yes, those contrails, doing the opposite of conspiracy theory. Is there an opportunity here to reduce warming impacts from all our flying around? Our guest Daniel Johansson is lead author of the paper Contrails, Aviation, and Climate Change, published in Nature Communications. Daniel is associate professor at the Department of Space, Earth, and Environment at Chalmers University of Technology. Chalmers is highly rated, kind of a Swedish MIT. From Gothenburg, Daniel Johansson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I look forward to sort of talk to you about sort of contrails.
Well, most of us have seen white aircraft trails, and sometimes they do become high clouds. What is a contrail, and why does this happen?
So basically, contrail is formed behind airplanes, and it's formed on the water vapor in the exhaust, together with also soot coming out from the exhaust. And under some conditions, if it's getting cold enough, this water vapor will condense on the particles emitted from the exhaust, and this is what we see as contrails. So basically, ice particles formed on the soot particles from the engine. And under some conditions, if it's sort of humid enough, these contrails will stay in the atmosphere for hours. So basically, for the contrails to form, it needs to be cold, say around minus 40 degrees Celsius, 45 degrees Celsius. And for them to stay around longer than a few minutes, it also needs to be humid enough in the atmosphere.
So we call these high clouds cirrus clouds. How long do they tend to last, and is it long enough to matter?
Yeah, so basically, we have these sort of contrails that disappears quickly, then they disappear quickly within a few minutes. These doesn't matter for the climate. And then we have the contrails, the persistent contrails. They usually stay a couple of hours, up to, say, 10 hours or something like that. And if they stay even longer, they sort of tend to form clouds that are indistinguishable from cirrus clouds. And then they can stay, say, up to 24 hours or even longer in the atmosphere. And these are the ones, the long-lived ones, the one that has a lifetime above a couple of hours, are the one that matters from the climate perspective.
We were told that clouds generally help cool the surface by reflecting solar energy back into space. Please explain why a high cirrus cloud stimulated by passing aircraft can create more warming than cooling.
So basically, all clouds, both sort of low-level clouds like cumulus clouds, and these high-level clouds, say cirrus clouds or contrails, affect solar radiation. They reflect solar radiation, so we get less solar radiation towards the ground. So that is true for both these sort of low-level clouds that causes sort of the shade, and also these higher-level clouds that are usually thinner. But also all clouds absorb infrared radiation coming from the Earth's surface going toward space and block that infrared radiation going out of space. And this is the mechanism causing a warming from the clouds. And it turns out from basic physics that this warming impact of the cloud will be larger the colder the cloud is. And the low-level clouds, it's usually warmer. It's so warmer closer to the surface in the atmosphere. And the higher clouds, high up in the atmosphere, say contrails and cirrus clouds, are typically much colder. And for that reason, they have a much stronger warming impact than the low-level clouds. And it is the net effect of the cooling impact of clouds, the reflection of the solar radiation, and the warming impact of the clouds, basically in the absorption of infrared radiation, that determines if a cloud, on average, is a warming or cooling cloud. So even these low-level clouds, they are warming during nighttime, but daytime, the reflection of the solar radiation is much stronger than the absorption of infrared radiation, causing them to be a warming. While for the contrails, they're always warming in the night, but they also have the effect of reflecting at daytime. So some contrails at daytime can actually be also cooling, and some of them at daytime can have a warming effect.
So what's the overall impact, though? Is it more warming than cooling?
It's more warming than cooling. So contrails on average are causing a warming, and quite strong such a warming.
The introduction to your paper says, quote, contrail cirrus, which currently has an effective radiation forcing comparable to that of aviation CO2, end quote. That's a big statement. Half of aircraft-induced warming is from contrails and not burning fossil fuels. How do you know that?
So basically, this is a topic that has been researched for about more than three decades. Actually, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, released a special report on aviation and climate in 1999, and already there they had this sort of assessment of the warming impacts of contrails versus that of carbon dioxide from aviation. So there has been research going on since then, and most of these research rely on models, climate models, or more specific models devoted for us towards assessing contrail cirrus. And these models show a warming, say, a radiative forcing, as it's called, or effective radiative forcing, that is on par with that of aviation CO2. Some models show a stronger warming of the contrail cirrus. Some are about the same for the contrail cirrus as that for aviation CO2. And some models point towards a slightly less warming of contrail cirrus compared to aviation CO2. So this is a sort of the source material for such a statement.
Are we at the point yet where we can predict and map specific conditions required to turn airplane exhaust into clouds?
Basically, from a statistical, a climatological perspective, we know fairly well where these contrails are formed. We can calculate statistically at which altitudes and over which seasons the chance of a contrail, a persistent contrail, is actually formed, and so on. But from a more, say, for a specific flight, it is much harder because it's hard to predict these places in the atmosphere where it's humid enough. We basically can quite easily calculate when it's cold enough, but we also need to know where it's humid enough. And this is much trickier to do forecasts on. So when it comes to actual changing flight routes and so on to avoid this area, it is tricky for the moment. We can do forecasts. There is some sort of possibility to redirect flights to avoid these areas, but it's still sort of pretty uncertain, and more research is needed to go into this specific topic.
But if we could do it, if a plane could avoid flying through contrail conditions with a diversion, that might mean more fuel burn, but it would reduce the overall impact on climate. It might be possible to do that?
Yes, that is sort of the hope from the industry and from many researchers for the moment, that this could be a mitigation option that could be also very low cost. Basically, that we can avoid, theoretically at least, a major fraction of the contrail forcing by emitting slightly more CO2 from the airplanes in the order of like a 1% additional fuel use or something like that, and then potentially avoid 50, 80, even theoretically up to 100% of the contrail forcing. But we are not really there yet, but it might be an option over the coming decade or so.
Your group also converted aircraft pollution into economic damages. What did you find?
So basically, what we did was that we wanted to understand if the numbers we referred to before, that the impact of contrails being roughly in terms of the effective radiated force equally large rate of aviation CO2, is based on sort of past aviation and what forcing has caused up to now. But when it comes to a decision, if you want to sort of mitigate climate change, we need to understand what are the consequences of our mitigation strategies. If we are going to sort of emit slightly more CO2 to avoid the contrails, we need to sort of assess the climate damages we avoid from now onto the, into the future of our actions. We need a forward-looking perspective. And that was the reason why we adopted this sort of a climate economic perspective. My intention was primarily to understand better what are the consequences causing contrails in terms of economic numbers, and also what are the consequences of emitting CO2. And from those insights, we could get sort of a better understanding if it's worthwhile doing this sort of shift of avoiding contrail forming regions and emitting slightly more CO2. And what we basically found, if you look at the global sort of global total impact of contrail series and global total impact of 1 year of CO2 emissions from aviation, the climate damages of the contrails is around sort of 10 up to 60% of that of CO2. So this is sort of the comparison of the importance from this economic perspective of reducing contrails versus the impact caused by CO2 emissions from aviation.
And along the way, you have to use something called a discount rate. Please explain what the discount rate means in terms of climate damages.
So the discount rate is an assumption, is an approach that is used in climate economic modeling and climate economic reasoning. It's very central for climate economic analysis. It's basically, if you make an assessment of the climate impacts of, say, emitting CO2, what are the consequences of emitting CO2 in economic numbers? We have something called social cost of carbon. And when estimating this social cost of carbon, we need to take into account what are the climate impacts in terms of numbers. If we emit 1 ton of CO2 today and add up all the economic consequences through basically the whole lifetime of CO2 in the atmosphere. So we need to analyze climate impacts over several hundred years into the future. When you're doing this type of analysis, we cannot just add up the numbers over time. We need to consider that it's quite likely that we will be better off in the future, we'll be richer in the future. And if you're going to estimate costs and benefits occurring now compared to costs and benefits occurring, say, 10 years into the future, 50 years into the future, and so on, and if we are richer in the future, we need to consider that the sort of the benefit or the utility we get from $1 extra 15 years from now when we are richer are worth less to us than the sort of having one additional dollar if we are poorer, for example. And this is the sort of the basic mechanism behind discounting, how to value costs and benefits over time if we get richer over time.
On another topic, last January you co-authored an article asking a difficult question: should climate policy focus more on methane or carbon dioxide? How does warming from methane compare to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere?
So this is a topic that is sort of relatively similar to the issue of contrails, actually. So basically, contrails are very short-lived in the atmosphere. They have a stay there for a few hours, up to a day. Methane is a greenhouse gas. It stays there for, say, one decade, and within two, 3 decades, most of the methane emissions are gone. Say that we emit methane today, it will be largely gone within 30 years from the atmosphere. CO2, on the other hand, is a very long-lived greenhouse gas. So if you emit CO2 today, after 100 years, 30% of that impact will still be present in the atmosphere. And after 1,000 years, roughly 20%. Of that sort of emission will be have an impact in the atmosphere. So these gases have very different properties in the atmosphere, and that was sort of the starting point for basically for the contrail paper we wrote that we have discussed so far, but also for the methane studies that we have analyzed, sort of, we need to understand the sort of temporal dimension of the different sort of climate impacts and of the different gases and forces to also make sort of sensible and effective policies for meeting climate targets. So this was a starting point. So methane is relatively short-lived compared to CO2, but when it comes to methane, it's a much stronger greenhouse gas than CO2. So if we look at the instantaneous impact in the atmosphere, if we emit 1 kilo of methane and compare that to 1 kilo of carbon dioxide, that kilo of methane is roughly 100 strong in terms of climate impact in compared to CO2.
It sounds strange to hear methane could be emitted in perpetuity. What do you mean by that?
So the thing is here that the starting point for the analysis and many of the climate discussion is that we want to stabilize global mean surface temperature at 1.5 up to 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial level. This is the targets that are discussed within the Paris Agreement and so on. And the climate impact of CO2 is that it accumulates in the atmosphere. So every time we emit one additional ton of CO2 to the atmosphere, it will increase the temperature level of the Earth, and it will sort of have that increase, of course, that increase in temperature lasting for hundreds and hundreds of years into the future. And the mechanism here that if we're going to stabilize the climate, given the sort of accumulative nature of the CO2 emissions need to go to net zero. Without having CO2 emissions being net zero, we will never be able to stabilize climate or the global mean surface temperature. Methane, on the other hand, since it's so much short-lived, we can sort of emit methane and sort of have a stable climate. Basically, if we emit 1 ton of methane every year, we will sort of increase the concentration of methane initially in the atmosphere, but eventually it will come in a steady state with emissions we have, causing sort of a fixed level of temperature contribution from methane. And that is the key, is the reason why we can have sort of ongoing emissions of methane and a stable climate, while for CO2, we cannot have that situation. We need to sort of reduce the emissions to net zero to have a stable climate.
Well, if I understood your work correctly, the later we leave emissions controls, the less relevant methane control becomes compared to CO2. And so would it be more economically effective to invest in methane control now, say, as we reach 1.5 degrees C of warming, but maybe not later at 2.5 degrees C of warming?
So in our sort of relatively recent study on methane, the mechanism is that sort of we look at the climate impacts of methane versus that of CO2, and we're using these economic damages from climate change. And these economic damages from climate change, they are increasing with the warming level, and they're actually increasing faster than the warming level. So basically, I'm talking about the marginal damages increases with the warming level. So basically, if you get a 3-degree warming, it will be much worse than just twice as much compared to a 1.5-degree warming, the damages of that. So we have this non-linear relationship between warming levels and damages. Based on such a reasoning, it becomes more important to reduce the CO2 emissions now compared to the methane emissions now if we expect that we will have continued warming in the future. We will not have any stabilization. Basically because if it becomes very hot in the future, reducing emissions now of carbon dioxide will have a sizable impact on warming, say 100, 200 years from now, while the impact of reducing methane now will be relatively small far off in the future when it becomes sort of hotter. And that is sort of a key reason why if we are pessimistic about the future, it is really CO2 that we need to worry about and that we should focus our climate policies on. But if you are really targeting, say, 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius, and if we believe that we will actually manage those temperature levels, it also becomes, in a relative sense, more important to also focus on methane.
Well, fossil fuel emissions have only increased in recent years and decades. We know that. Does that guarantee a faster rate of warming by increasing our rate of emissions? What do you think?
So basically, we know that we have a relatively linear relationship between cumulative amount of CO2 emissions and temperature level. And that basically implies that if you have constant emissions of carbon dioxide, anthropogenic emissions going to the atmosphere, it will increase the global mean surface temperature roughly at a constant rate. So now the temperature contribution from CO2 is roughly 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade. That is sort of the rate of change in global mean surface temperatures, perhaps somewhat slightly higher. And that is sort of is related to the level of CO2 emissions we have for the moment. If we were to increase our amount of CO2 emissions per year, that increase in the rate, and the rate of temperature change will also go up. So we know that sort of increasing CO2 emissions is causing a constant increase in the temperature of the Earth.
Well, let's go back to your study on aviation emissions and contrails. Daniel, you advised the auto industry on emissions regulations. What can you offer for the airline industry to help reduce their climate impact?
So basically, our starting point in this study was maybe not directly focusing on the airline industry, but rather to focus on if we want to sort of regulate the airline industry or have policies that are sort of incentivized reductions of a contrail series forcing. So that was our starting point. So more from the regulatory perspective than the airline perspective. And the reason for that is that the European Commission has plans to have some type of regulation focusing on reducing contrails and other non-CO2 forced aviation within a couple of years from now. But also from an airline perspective, we hope that our research and numbers could contribute to make proper assessment of the worth of actually avoiding contrail series and to how to sort of value these reductions compared to potential increases in the CO2 emissions they may cause if they have rerouting of air flights as a strategy, for example.
Well, given current weather disasters and scientific predictions, I think we need to slash air travel to a tiny fraction of today's busy skies, at least until we can find a clean source of energy for flight. I worry a move to avoid contrails might decrease action to reduce mass air travel. Could efforts to control contrails delay fundamental emissions reductions?
I understand your worry, but from my perspective, and if our aim is to be consistent and really meet the Paris Agreement target, we need to move forward on all fronts, reducing sort of all types of anthropogenic climate impacts and not just focusing on CO2. We need to consider CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, and so on. So it's important to consider all sources contributing to climate change. So that is sort of my perspective on it. It would be worrisome if it is used as an excuse to not developing clean fuels for aviation or not considering sort of reduction in flying, for example, but it's sort of used in parallel with other strategies so we can meet sort of the climate targets in the Paris Agreement.
Over the years, you investigated many aspects of Earth systems. What are you working on next?
So for the moment, besides these issues of contrail and aviation, one of my key interests is this issue of overshoot in temperature levels. So basically, we have these targets of 1.5 up to 2 degrees Celsius within the Paris Agreement. But as the case is now, the global mean surface temperature has more or less already is close to the level of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, and it's virtually sure certain that we cannot manage the 1.5 degree limit in the Paris Agreement without a temporary overshoot in it going up towards higher temperatures. And my research interests are partly are focusing on sort of what are the strategies and how can we plan for now for removing CO2 from the atmosphere, which could be a strategy to also reduce the global mean surface temperature. There could also be possibilities of removing methane from the atmosphere, which also could be a way of reducing the temperature after we have sort of passed this 1.5 degree target. So my research is focusing both on these strategies, understanding them, and also understanding them what type of policies could be used for incentivizing such futures, but also what could be the consequences of having a higher level of warming during a sort of a limited period and then sort of reduce the temperature of in the longer term.
From Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden, we've been talking with Associate Professor Daniel Johansson. Daniel will be a lead author in the next report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. You can find links to all the science we just discussed in my weekly show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Daniel, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You know about tipping points, where natural states enter unstoppable change. From disappearing glaciers to ocean current flips, tipping points keep scientists up at night. We may not know critical change happens except in the rearview mirror of time. Here is such a hidden case. In 2003, tens of thousands of Europeans died in a heat wave beyond anything seen before. We did not know that at the same time a heat wave killed and changed ocean life in the North Atlantic. This single event changed everything from tiny crabs to giant whales. Marine heat waves are getting bigger, hotter, and longer as we heat up the world. Could another defining marine heat wave be on the way? We go to the new paper, Major Heat Wave in the North Atlantic Had Widespread and Lasting Impacts on Marine Life. The lead author is Dr. Carl Michael Werner, research scientist at the Thunen Institute of Sea Fisheries in Bremerhaven, Germany. From Bremerhaven, Carl Michael Werner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thank you, Alex, and good evening from Germany.
Just as an introduction, how would you describe the marine heat wave of 2003?
The marine heat wave of 2003 was widespread, and it covered large parts of the subpolar North Atlantic. And just as an example, from southeast Greenland, the August temperatures there switched from around usually 5 to 6 degrees to 7 to 8 degrees just within that 1 year. So that was a huge change. And the difference to the time before was that the 2003 marine heat wave was very widespread in the subpolar North Atlantic. Not before small local heat waves, but a widespread large heat wave.
How do you define a marine heat wave in this study? And how can we know area or heat is increasing in recent decades?
So our approach was that we used what is called a high percentile threshold method. So for this purpose, we defined a reference period of normal temperatures. In our case, it was from 1870 to 1969, from which we calculated the so-called 99th percentile. For the subsequent years, we associated a temperature value with a heat wave. If that temperature value exceeded this so-called 99th percentile, that just means that it's a very, very rare event.
And how do we know that heat is increasing in recent decades or that we're getting more marine heat waves?
Well, we are observing much more of these extreme events in recent years. So the year 2003 was kind of the start or the starting bell, how we would say in Germany, to a huge increase in the frequency of marine heat waves, and that is through counting extreme temperature values in different places in the subpolar North Atlantic.
Why are we only discovering the magnitude of a marine heat wave that happened more than 20 years ago? Why now?
Well, because it naturally takes time to measure the stability of the ecological implications. So if we do see ecological changes following a physical extreme event, we need to wait for maybe 10 or 20 years to also be able to say that was, for example, a regime shift or a tipping point. So stability in an ecological change implies more than just 1 or 2 years, and that's why we naturally have to wait to be able to say that we had a tipping point or a regime shift, for example.
After the 2003 North Atlantic heat wave, maybe one study reports a change in cod fishing, others talk about different species across a few different regions. How did you manage to create an overview of the big range of living things, large and small, in the North Atlantic, which is a vast area?
Yeah, that's a good question, Alex. Well, we searched the literature. We searched a lot of literature, and we read a lot of papers and looked at a lot of temperature time series, and time series of ecological and biological parameters, so distribution of organisms and changes in distribution of organisms, diet composition of organisms. So do we see changes in food web interactions, for example? And we did this with experts from different areas and different taxonomic or functional groups.
Why would a marine heat wave up there affect whales? Can't they just swim to cooler waters if they need to?
So the whales, especially in southeast Greenland, they likely followed the food. So we did see a change in the distribution of the most important forage fish species in the subpolar North Atlantic. It's called capelin. And through larger areas of ice melting in East Greenland, these areas were kind of invaded by capelin, and the whales just followed them. So it was less about too high temperatures for the whales, rather than that areas which were previously ice-covered increased and they got kind of more productive or more attractive for whales, and the whales moved there.
The impacts of the 2003 sea heat did not end in 2003. Can you describe ongoing impacts even a couple of years later or perhaps now?
Thanks, Alex, for this question. This is a difficult question because the factors affecting distribution of these organisms we described, so everything from zooplankton over small fish species, so-called forage fish species, or larger fish species, predatory species like cod or whales, these factors affecting the distribution and, for example, food web interactions, they began to mix over time. So what we see is that 2003 had a huge impact, but after that, the different factors such as fishing, for example, they started to mix and affect the organisms differently. So, for example, you could see changes after 2003, maybe a decade or two decades, but this was cross-generational. So we had one, for example, in 2003 was a huge cohort, or which means a very high survival of fish in the early life stages of haddock in Iceland. But then that large cohort also led to a high adult biomass in the years after, and that occurrence of high adult biomass had, again, other factors, like, for example, density-dependent factors. So it's difficult to disentangle these different factors now, 10 or 20 years after the actual heat wave. But what I can say is that the big picture now is very similar to how it changed in and right after 2003.
If impacts are not all the same for similar ocean extreme events, where does that leave us? I mean, why do you think marine heat waves in the following years, some of similar intensity to 2003, did not result in the same big impacts?
This is a good and a difficult question. So it's mainly speculation, but I personally think that it needs another considerably stronger heat wave to have the same effect again. So most heat waves after 2003 were of smaller or similar magnitude, but the temperatures in the heat waves after 2003 were seldomly higher than in 2003, or they were not as much higher compared to 2003 as 2003 had to the period before. So what I think, but that is speculation, is that it would need another strong and sudden abrupt increase in temperature again to have similar ecological implications to what we saw in 2003. But predicting these ecological changes is very difficult, so I couldn't say what would happen then.
After 2003, you found a drop in zooplankton in the Norwegian Sea, but higher plankton productivity just a little further north. Can we generalize about the 2003 marine heat wave impacts on plankton in the North Atlantic?
I don't think that a generalization is possible because local conditions are very different in the different places in the North Atlantic. So where we saw a drop in zooplankton biomass, that was in the Norwegian Sea, but at the same time we saw an increase in plankton biomass, that was considerably further north. So you called it a little further north, but it's actually around 1,000 kilometers going into the Fram Strait, which is the gate to the Arctic Ocean, where this increase in temperature led to an increase in productivity. So it's difficult to generalize because one always has to look at the very specific local conditions in the different places.
Did the 2003 heat wave change commercial fisheries in the North Atlantic?
Yes, I would say so, to some degree, yes. For example, in East Greenland, the cod fishery started again, which was closed before. And that was likely because of a very large cohort which was born or which hatched in the year of 2003. And although it's a bit more difficult to relate it so directly to 2003, also the mackerel fishery, which is a huge fishery in the Northeast Atlantic, was likely related, or this rise in the mackerel fishery, or that stock expansion of mackerel, which we saw in the Northeast Atlantic, was also likely related to the heat wave in 2003. So yes, it did have an impact on commercial fishing.
Is it fair to say this 2003 heat wave caused or added to a mass migration of species toward the pole?
So I think we need to disentangle a bit the mechanisms behind the phrase of mass migration or behind this phrase or saying species moving north. So when we say that during these events or with warming species are moving north, that just means that for some species, adults which can actively swim and they change the distribution, they move north because that's where they find better conditions. But at the same time, species moving north could mechanistically also mean that the survival of the early life stages for fish species, for example, changes for the different populations. So every fish species in the North Atlantic, or usually most of them, have different populations. There are some further north and there are some further south. And what we see is usually that as soon as it gets warmer in the subpolar North Atlantic, which is more ice affected and where we do have more also seasonal ice, that a lot of boreal species, for example, they like these conditions when it gets warmer. And they don't necessarily, the adults don't necessarily have to move northwards, but what we see is, for example, that in the northern populations, the likelihood of survival in the very early life stages, so eggs and larvae, suddenly increases. So it doesn't necessarily have to be an active migration, how we see, for example, seasonal feeding migrations or spawning migrations of whales or fish, but it could also mean a change in mortality or survival rates of different life stages of these organisms. So I think a mass migration is maybe a bit too strong, but we do see substantial changes, and we did see substantial responses across all of these different life stages. So we saw that adults started to migrate somewhere else, somewhere further north to spawn, for example. They went somewhere and started to prey upon smaller fish, and we did see changes in the survivability of eggs and larvae. So all of these factors started to interact as well.
For too long, we assumed a return to former normal conditions would just restore the collection of life back to the way it was. And we found that wasn't true here in Canada of the North Atlantic cod fishery after those fish crashed from overfishing. Something else took its place. Talk to us about what this means for short, extreme heat events in the sea.
Yeah, that's a good question. And, of course, a very valid and valuable observation you mentioned from the Canadian cod stock and the Canadian cod fishery. But it's also, again, a bit difficult to answer. So for the cod fisheries also, as we saw here in front of our own door in the Baltic Sea, for example, when these fisheries and the stock collapsed and it never came back, usually several factors interacted, not only physical ecological changes in the environment, but also fishing. So when we have these collapses, or when we saw these collapses, and even after one of the stressors was removed and it did not come back to the ecosystem it was before, that means that in the first place, or one factor was that you had deteriorating conditions for cod, and secondly, you also had fishing, and fishing pressure was not adequately removed. And these two things, or the impacts of these two stressors interacted and led to a collapse of the fishery and also to a fundamental change in the ecosystem. For short events, for short extreme events like heat waves, for example, local heat waves, I actually do think that it is different and that these changes can change back. So this is also what we saw, for example, in the Barents Sea to some degree. It doesn't always change back, but if it is just a short physical pulse, I think they could change back. But again, when there are several stresses interacting at the same time, then for me, or what I see, the picture changes.
We have the most data collected on commercial fisheries and less about fundamentals of ocean life, including plankton, but also many species with no apparent value to humans. Where do we need to put more scientists and research money to really know what is going on as we superheat the sea periodically?
I think we need to monitor the ocean. So what we have to do is that, or what the take-home message from that project was, the main take-home message, we need more data. We need more observations of the distribution of different species, of different organisms across all trophic levels, starting from phytoplankton, zooplankton, small fish, up to the huge predators. And we need to monitor regularly their trophic interactions. So we need to see who eats who and how the species change their distribution in response to the environment. And in order to relate changes in distribution and changes in species interactions to the environment, we need to go out with our ships and we need to observe. That is, I think, the most important message I learned from this paper, is that usually when we cannot explain what we see, or we are missing pieces in the puzzle, it is because we don't have biological observations from the environment.
Carl, did the after effects of that 2000 marine heat wave impact Arctic sea life as well?
To some degree, yes, because ice was lost, and if sea ice melts, that usually has a huge impact on the ecosystem, which was formerly covered with sea ice. But in the actual Arctic, which is still ice covered, I don't think so much, because the ice is still there, and the ice is an important driver of everything in the ocean below. And in the Arctic, the ice is still there. So in the core Arctic, up around the North Pole, where we still do have ice, I don't think there were big effects.
Could we call the 2000 marine heat wave in the North Atlantic a tipping point?
Yes, Alex. For many areas in the North Atlantic, this seems to be correct, that we can call this a tipping point.
And there might be more in ocean life in coming marine heat waves. Are there surprises out there as humans cause more global warming?
Definitely, yes. There will be surprises. So the first thing I think we need in the future is to be able to predict heat waves on a physically, so to know when these happen, when they will happen, and how strong they will be. And when we have that, and I think that already is very, very difficult. I'm not a physicist or a physical oceanographer, but I think this is already a huge challenge. And then we can actually try to forecast or to predict or make scenarios about changing in biodiversity or changing in distributions of different organisms. But I think most of the times we will rather be late and look back and see the changes after they actually occurred. And yes, there will be surprises.
A key factor in the supermarine heat wave of 2003 in the North Atlantic was something called the subpolar gyre. It's like a giant whirlpool south of Iceland. It was weak in 2003, letting warmer water from the subtropics into the Norwegian Sea, as I understand it. But was the weak subpolar gyre a result of the ocean heat, or was the ocean heat distributed by the gyre? How does that work?
As far as I understand, it's not resolved yet. So the physical oceanographers are currently arguing about whether the subpolar gyre is the result, or whether changes in the subpolar gyre and the strength of the subpolar gyre are the result of changes in ocean heat content, or if it's the other way around. So if changes in the subpolar gyre strength change ocean heat content. That is currently the discussion, and yeah, it's kind of the old chicken and egg issue, so it's difficult to say what comes first, the change in the subpolar gyre or the change in ocean heat content.
The main body of climate science so far has been collecting facts to create long-term trends, like we make a graph of carbon dioxide over the last 100 years. I think this leaves out an important part of climate change, the impacts of short, severe impacts that may be lost in long averages, but really, really matter. What do you think?
Absolutely correct. So when it comes to ecology, I think these extreme events are actually equally important compared to gradual slow changes or linear changes. The problem is that the impacts of these short severe events on biodiversity, for example, are much more difficult to predict, as we talked about a few minutes ago, than gradual or long-term changes where you can make assumptions and you can see how, for example, distribution of species or growth of organisms changes. But with these short extreme events, all of these things, or trying to predict ocean life becomes much, much, much more difficult.
There have been severe heat waves in Europe since the killer heat of 2003. Nowhere near so many people died in later heat waves, though. Society and families adapted. Could that be the case with the ocean mystery, where subsequent ocean heat waves in the North Atlantic did not have the same game-changing impacts?
that's an interesting question. Well, I'm not so sure how, if me as a fisheries ecologist, if I'm allowed to compare organisms in the ocean and humans on land, but maybe there are similar patterns, or maybe there are similar processes taking place. So maybe, yeah, but that is just pure speculation from my side.
Is there anything else you would like to tell us about this new paper or about your current research? Please take as long as you would like. We'd like to hear from you.
Most of the most important points were already mentioned. There were a lot of good questions, and I think we were really able to dive also into the details of what happened. What might be interesting are the future steps, and I think one of the most important lessons or messages out of this paper or future questions is why different heat waves do not affect the ocean in the same way. So we do have heat waves. We did have heat waves after 2003, but they did not have the same impacts as the heat wave in 2003. And we really don't know why yet. And I think that understanding the potential of heat waves to affect ecosystems differently, even in the same place and with a similar magnitude of intense, the ecological implications were different. I think that is the most important future question to answer for us marine ecologists.
From the Thunen Institute of Sea Fisheries in Bremerhaven, Germany, we have been speaking with the research scientist Carl Michael Werner. Find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog, Wednesdays, at ecoshock.org. Carl, thank you for helping our listeners understand this.
Alex, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you, and thanks a lot for inviting me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This new science on the North Atlantic Ocean heat wave of 2003 is part of a new vision and new capabilities entering the climate debate. We start to have data and computer power to investigate particular incidents, events that may only last days, but impacts that last years or longer. Some fast changes are irreversible. This is part of a long-standing debate within science, uniformitarianism versus catastrophism. The founder of the theory of uniformitarianism was Scottish geologist and naturalist James Hutton in the late 1700s. His vision of slow change in rocks over time was much longer than the 6,000 years of the Bible. It revolutionized understanding of Earth's history. That was then promoted later in the 1800s by Charles Lyell, and it influenced Charles Darwin's theory of the origin of our species. Opposing the uniformists is the theory of catastrophism. It suggests Earth's geological features and all things were formed by sudden, violent, and short-lived events rather than slow, uniform processes. This view was raised by the French naturalist and zoologist Georges Cuvier in the early 1800s. Catastrophism has a lot of friends on YouTube, but few in science. But now, short, significant events are making a comeback. We don't need to deny the importance of slow changes and global averages over long periods. We just need to add something new, more science of particular, spectacular events that leave irreversible changes in following time. The heat wave of 2003 is just such a case. It killed at least 50,000 people in Europe, but also many species in the sea. This may be the best documented case of a combined heat wave on both land and sea. This is new to us. Now it's time for Radio EcoShock News Bites. For the first time in human records, mosquitoes reached Iceland, previously mosquito-free. Too bad. While millions shiver in the Arctic vortex, unstable weather continues in the southern hemisphere. Wildfires in Chile displaced 50,000 people. That was visible from space. Australia got through its monster heat wave followed by Cyclone Koji in Queensland. To be honest, there has been less extreme in the southern hemisphere overall this year than last. So far, La Niña continues. But we know, day after day, more heat goes into the great southern ocean than comes out. And that's not going to work out well. Back in Europe, it is winter. Storm Henry battered the Mediterranean last week with floods in Italy, Spain, and France. Earlier in January, Storm Goretti has swept the UK with exceptionally strong winds, heavy snow, significant rain, but it's winter. North America got wind chills of minus 40 degrees in the U.S. Midwest and Arctic temperatures and lots of snow in the Northeast. Scientists disagree among themselves whether these incursions of the polar vortex are caused by climate change in the Arctic. There is a snow drought in the west, except for coastal mountains. That may mean water shortages this summer and wildfire conditions for the west. Canadian government forecasters predict 2026 will be another in the latest string of years far hotter than in previous decades. We will see what this new year brings. Insurance losses from natural catastrophes went over $100 billion for the sixth year in a row. That's according to insurance giant Swiss Re. About 83% of those losses were in the United States. The 2025 fires in Los Angeles were the most expensive insured event in world history. Planned obsolescence, remember that? We heard it in the 1960s. Products designed to wear out or break after the warranty expires. That keeps consumers coming back, return customers, don't you know? Now with trillion-dollar new investments, more coal, oil, and gas, that's planned obsolescence for the whole civilization. Oh, sure, we try to rebuild as fast as things break down, in wave after wave of unnatural instability, until we can't. Don't tell the kids. Snatch what joy we can. Snatch it. Remember to treasure a normal day, old style, even a normal hour. Put love and not waste into the atmosphere around you. Next week, we explore oil power struggles and why not, AI swarms. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. You